This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
Thanks so much for joining us on this rainy Saturday, but we have a great program. I always learn a lot on Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, and I'm sure you will learn a lot as well if you join us for the entire hour today. Tom Schroyer hosting. Tom Sharon, a frequent guest on the program today, and back in the spotlight, the internet. It continues to become a bigger and bigger part of everyone's world. And we're going to delve into some of the legal issues associated with the internet and its growing influence on our lives.
Exactly right, Steve. The internet continues to clash with the antitrust laws as of course, the very things that make the internet great, namely its scalability, its ever presence, its flexibility, also make it ripe for the exercise of anti-competitive power, and of course that's regulated by the antitrust laws. And Tom, I'll echo Steve's comment at the start, or at the start of the show, which is I really learn a lot getting ready for your shows in particular. It's just amazing how much detail and complexity there is to the antitrust law. And then when you add to that the internet and all that's going on there, it is really quite amazing all that's happening and how much there is to learn and to know about that. And, of course, Tom Sharon is well qualified to explain that, Steve. He's certified as a civil trial specialist by the Minnesota State Bar Association, and he's also a former past chair and continuing member of the Minnesota Bar Association's antitrust law section, as well as an instructor at the University of St. Thomas in its software program. So, Tom, welcome back.
Glad to be here. I agree. It should be interesting this morning. We've got a lot to talk about. One thing to start off with is we're looking at the internet and the antitrust laws, and one thing to keep in mind is that the antitrust laws are there to protect competition, not specific individual competitors. And in the internet, we've got a lot of sort of new and disruptive technologies that may adversely impact individual competitors, but the antitrust laws aren't necessarily there to prevent that from happening. If it's the result of innovation, that's competition too, is a form of innovation. Innovation is a form of competition as well.
Right. We might hearken back to the turn of the last century and say that the antitrust law is not intended to save the village blacksmith from the incursion of the automobile industry when it was starting out. And indeed, who knows where the chips will fall when the internet revolution is fully realized.
That's for sure. And there are, the wayside is littered already with companies that either were unwilling or unable to adopt to these new technologies. And that's presumably going to continue to happen. As long as it produces consumer benefits and better products, better choice, lower prices, that's what the antitrust laws are there to promote.
I mean, I know you were here in January to talk about the fury, the concern, maybe a better word, over how the Google search engine allocates priorities on its results being shown based upon algorithms that Google adopts and does not disclose. And, Tom, we had a great discussion about that in January, and it was just in the news again this week.
It's the Federal Trade Commission, which is monitors this type of activity. The Federal Trade Commission shares with the Justice Department the responsibility of enforcing the federal antitrust laws, and they're an administrative agency, so they can just sort of track businesses and see whether they're being anti-competitive or not, more so than Justice, which tends to be more reactive. And the FTC, as well as the Competition Commission in Europe, are both examining the Google algorithm based on complaints largely from competitors that Google now is in the business of providing services as well as search results, and it's favoring its own companies over those of allegedly favoring its own companies over over those of its competitors. It's very much up in the air, though. I think we stay tuned. I don't think there's any intuitive or obvious antitrust problem here.
And, Tom, there's no doubt Google is going to protect that algorithm and the proprietary information, all they've invested in creating this search engine that's become almost invaluable when using the internet. I'm sure they're lawyering up, if you will, to fight this tooth and nail.
Well, absolutely. If there's any power that Google has in the marketplace, it's the result of that, the efficiency of that algorithm and the broad consumer acceptance of that very valuable service. And the FTC cited a lawyer, but I read the other day that Google's also hired a guy named Robert Bork, who's sort of a guru in the antitrust area, and he wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal recently saying that there was if the wrongdoing is abusing dominance by Google, then it's counterintuitive because Google would, if it were actually destroying the integrity of that search result by favoring its own firms, it would be shooting itself in the foot, depriving itself of the very power that it's being accused of having.
And also, of course, whether it's an apt argument or not, Robert Bork, who listeners may recall, was shot down in his appointment to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. So he's doing quite well for himself here. Nonetheless, Mr. Bork argued that consumers are always one click away from a competing search engine called Bing.
Absolutely, and Yahoo, and there are other. The general search market is relatively limited and concentrated, but there are no entry barriers other than Google's vastly superior performance in terms of getting general search results. So as long as there are no entry barriers and there's competition out there, a claim based on market dominance gets a little bit difficult to make. And as you said, Steve, Google has a proprietary interest in the intellectual property in its algorithm. And to make disclosures of that would be deprive it of that intellectual property benefit, as well as give a roadmap to people to try to scam the search capability and undermine its effectiveness. So there's a lot to this story, and we'll have to wait and see.
I suppose it all boils down to the old mousetrap. Google right now is building a better mousetrap, and I suppose it's difficult in antitrust law to balance. Hey, they're just doing it better. There are competitors out there. They just can't keep up.
Well, that's right. You know, an aside that's not it's not antitrust, but it's sort of an interesting serendipitous thing. Google has trouble with its trademark because it's become so widespread that it's become a verb as well as a name, where people
like
say,
Kleenex.
Yeah, exactly. And they have to they're actively trying to
nice problem to have for most businesses.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
And Thomas, we're going to segue from that into talking about sort of a way in which the internet is actually perhaps going to help solve a different kind of market power or concentration, and that has to do with the lock that some of the large banks have on our primary mode of payment anymore these days, especially on the internet, and that's the credit card system.
Yeah, the thing about the credit card system at 30,000 feet is that it, like a lot of networks, and that's what it is at base.
In a way, it was one of the earlier versions of the internet, right?
Exactly. It's an information network, computerized, computer enhanced. And it like a lot of networks, it has a basic platform that has both network effects, which the more users you have, the more valuable it is. And it also has a two-sided effect, so that you have merchants on the one side and card users on the other. And depending on price sensitivity, the operator of one of those networks, like Visa and MasterCard, can subsidize one side of that network by charging the other side, and that's what happens here with the merchants having to pay all the interchange fees, and you and I, the cardholders, really get a 30-day float on our money and other perks and benefits that we don't pay for. That's all being subsidized by the merchants. And the problem here is that the price for the service, the interchange fee, gets disconnected from the actual cost, and that's the problem from an antitrust standpoint.
We'll come back after the break, Tom, and continue with that topic.
Tom Schroyer, Tom Sharon in studio. Antitrust laws in the internet age. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett's attorneys help to found and remain active in the Minnesota Legal Advice Clinics and similar organizations, including the Fund for the Legal Aid Society?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Saturdays between 11 and noon, of course. For more on today's program and all our programs, go online. We have a great website for you, Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. Spell it out, Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. Tom Schroyer, hosting Tom Sharon, Antitrust Laws in the Internet Age. Great program, great topic, and this stuff impacts all of us.
Anybody who's tried to use the internet to make a purchase sure. knows that there are really only three ways to do so, and that is by something called PayPal, which ends up, in my world anyway, revolving to the two other ways, which are MasterCard or Visa or, I guess, American Express or Discover Card. So, Tom, if you don't have a credit card and you want to shop the internet, you're really kind of out of luck. And that's just the way it is right now. But I understand that the credit card companies may be viewing the internet now not necessarily as a boon, but perhaps as a potential threat.
Well, the banks that are actually comprise the entities that are Visa and MasterCard are the ones who stand to be adversely affected if there is a if they are displaced in this system. Or if the system moves to a situation where they cannot charge these interchange fees that I spoke about a moment ago. These interchange fees and the various terms that apply to credit cards, which is, by the way, right now, and the whole market is primarily a point-of-sale-based credit card system that everybody's familiar with, where you swipe your card at the point-of-sale, and the reader at that point takes the information that's on that magnetic swipe at the back and reads it into the system, and it's automated from there on. And the banks and the card issuers really control that magnetic tape and control the card experience now. They're concerned that it would move away from that in a way that would either produce different types of payments, substitute types of payment, or payments situations which would force them to reduce their interchange fees. By the way, there's a long history of antitrust litigation involving these interchange fees, and the card companies have been a frequent target of that litigation.
I understand there's some big class action going to trial just this fall.
Well, yes, there is. In fact, that lawsuit, which was filed back in 2006, was filed on the anniversary of an earlier lawsuit. There have been two merchant lawsuits and two government suits that I'm aware of involving these cards. Back in 1996, a merchant group led by Walmart brought an antitrust suit against the card companies challenging their debit card interchange fees and got a big judgment and prospective relief in the area of debit card charges, which have now been the subject of additional regulation, by the way. But then 10 years later, this an even bigger merchant group filed another lawsuit, antitrust class action, directed at the credit card interchange fees, as well as the rules preventing card companies from surcharging Master or Visa card or giving incentives to card holders to use other cards. That kind of a rule has been used by the card companies to prevent merchants who are paying these interchange fees from passing those costs down or making the card users feel those costs. And those rules are being charged by this big lawsuit now that's going to trial in the fall.
I understand that, though, that there are some technologies that are becoming available on the internet that may be, as you put it, disruptive of that system of credit card-based payments.
Yeah, there are two online or two alternate payment systems that are out there. The one online alternate payment system involves an actual person-to-person payment alternative, the PayPal-type systems that you mentioned. I think also Google Checkout maybe might be the similar where...
How does PayPal differ from the credit cards?
Well, PayPal is a... You actually open up account as a both a buyer and a seller. You open up an account with PayPal. As a buyer, you can fund that account with your credit card or by direct electronic funds transfer from a bank account. You can actually maintain a cash account, is my understanding. On the seller side, you have to set up an account by which you either have a depository account with Google or you have a system that will permit – I'm sorry, I'm saying Google with the PayPal, or you set up an account system that can permit PayPal to electronically transfer funds to your depository bank account. So it displaces it has the potential to displace the credit cards, but to the extent that buyers are simply funding their eBay account with a credit card, it's not that big of an innovation. The thing to think about is that, you know, it's not that necessarily that far away to be a disruptive innovation, but there'd have to be a lot of consumer acceptance with it. And basically the problem here is that the consumers aren't really paying for anything.
We
in the
don't
current
feel
credit
the pain,
card system.
Right.
Exactly, right.
We have more on the way. It is Tom Scheuer hosting Tom Sharon. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Antitrust laws in the Internet age. We'll take a quick break for the weather. We'll come back with more in a moment. News Radio 830 WCCO. Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. For more background on today's program, feel free to go online. Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. Our phone number on the program, 651-989-9226, toll free, 1-866-989-9226. Text the studio as well, 81807, that's 81807, and that is powered by Home Service Plus, an offering of CenterPoint Energy. Tom Scheuer hosting Tom Sharon, antitrust laws in the Internet age, and I've already learned a lot on the program. One of the things that the Internet is having a huge impact, and that's good old bricks and mortar stores that exist and strip malls and shopping centers in every corner in the country. It is having an impact on their business.
Yeah, exactly right, Steve. We wanted to talk about that process. I believe, Tom, you call it disintermediation.
Yeah, ever since e-commerce came on the scene, people, economists, and others have been talking about how it might increase in efficiency by eliminating unnecessary middlemen, and that the term they use is disintermediation. The intermediate piece is just being dissed as a result of new technology and e-commerce. And that's been happening. There have been a number of companies that were unable to or couldn't adapt that have been just bowled over by the e-commerce. Locally, we have one of the big corporate citizens who are being adversely affected here with Best Buy. It's got its CEO problems, of course, but it's also got basic business model problems, having lost a big market share. Originally to pirates and also to becoming turned into a showroom for people to come look at the product and then go online and get it cheaper from e-commerce website.
But okay, Tom, is this more an area of, as we were talking in the last half hour, about the village blacksmith being shown the door in favor of the automobile, or is this an area where the antitrust laws and their regulation of anti-competitive activity can play a role?
Well, one really interesting antitrust issue that this highlights, it hasn't come to the fore with Best Buy yet, or really with other bricks and mortar companies that are being impacted by e-commerce. But a couple years ago, 2007, the Supreme Court came down with a decision that overruled 100 years of precedent that vertical price fixing or resale price maintenance
was per se illegal under this recent Supreme Court decision. It became not per se illegal under the antitrust law, but neither is it per se legal.
So let's give the listeners an example here. Is this like when, for example, in 30 years ago, the Izod shirts were so popular because they were so exclusive, and then the next thing we know, they're being discounted everywhere in town. They lose their exclusivity, and nobody wants an Izod shirt anymore.
Yeah, right. And what the Supreme Court said is that that can be a factor. That vendors like suppliers, manufacturers, Izod can consider vertical price fixing as distinguished from horizontal price fixing, which is still per se illegal. But vertical price fixing.
So horizontal price fixing would be if every shirt maker got together and said, "Here's the price we're going to charge."
Exactly.
That's per se illegal.
Right. That's always has been, always is. That's the first degree murder of antitrust law. But vertical is different because you have to distinguish between inter-brand competition and intra-brand competition. Vertical restraints on competition, including price, can reduce intra-brand competition, but the Supreme Court in this Ligon decision I'm talking about in 2007 said that they might have a favorable impact on at least non-price inter-brand competition. Now, the way it comes into play with Best Buy is that if the vendors, the suppliers, the Hewlett-Packards, the Sony, Samsung, wanted to, they could, under this Ligon decision, enter into resale price maintenance agreements with online sellers or any dealer or distributor.
Or bricks and mortar.
Bricks and mortar.
Retailers.
And just setting a floor, the price that they have to pay, and equalizing the price at the bricks and mortar store and online. Apparently, they have the suppliers on their own haven't decided to do that, and Best Buy apparently isn't in a position by itself to force that to happen.
But that still wouldn't get around the issue of folks, for whatever reason, preferring to buy online a TV or some other, especially big ticket item, which, after all, comes without the state sales tax, at least in most instances.
Well, the sales tax is a very interesting issue, not strictly antitrust. It's more a constitutional issue having to do with the tax collection piece of sales taxes. But it isn't a competition issue because, to the extent that online stores are not forced to collect sales tax, they are favored, and the bricks and mortar firms are disfavored to the tune of about 6%, 7%, 8% on every sale, and that, of course, can make a big difference. So it has the effect of making the playing field even more unequal than the regular market forces do in the case of online versus bricks and mortar.
And state governments would love to have a say in that. They would love to collect the sales tax, and there are states making moves to do that and try and rein this in and get together and try and capture this revenue.
Well, absolutely. In fact, this next month we're going to have the 20th anniversary of an old Supreme Court decision, the Quill decision that came out of North Dakota involving a catalog firm, where the court laid down the principle that states cannot force outstate firms to actually collect sales taxes unless those firms have a physical presence in the state. It's not a question of whether the sales tax applies. It's a question of who's going to collect it. And the court held that if for a state to impose collection responsibility on an out-of-state firm without physical presence in the state was an unreasonable burden on interstate commerce. And as you know, we know from the Affordable Care Act kerfuffle that's going on, that the control of interstate commerce is given to Congress, the federal Congress, under the Constitution, not the states.
We have more on the way. Tom Scheuer, Tom Scheuer, antitrust laws in the internet age. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back with more in a moment. News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know the shareholders of Moss & Barnett elected attorney Ann Newhall as president of the firm back in 1999? making it one of the very first firms to be led by a woman.
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Saturday is between 11 and noon. Tom Schreuer, Tom Sharon in studio, antitrust laws in the internet age. Tom?
Steve, thanks. We're going to do a quick return to the issue of the sales taxes because, Tom, I understand that Amazon recently reached agreement in Texas to pay some sales tax on intrastate purchases via the Amazon buying network.
Yeah, that's right. It was reported in the Wall Street Weekend Edition that Amazon struck a deal with Texas. They're going to start collecting taxes. But the thing about the Texas situation is that they Amazon operated a warehouse in the Dallas area, I believe, and they denied that they were physically present because it was run through a subsidiary. This was kind of a bogus game that they've been playing in several states, and they've negotiated similar deals with other states, and now they're doing it in Texas. They're going to get an excuse for past tax obligation because they're going to put up a new big warehouse in somewhere in Texas and create 25,000 jobs or something. And so it's a bargain on both sides. But I think Amazon sees the writing on the wall. It is now supporting legislation in Congress that will enable states to charge require online stores to charge sales tax, particularly if they buy onto this interstate compact that simplifies state and local sales tax procedures and makes it easier for the online sellers to collect it. That's pending in Congress, and Amazon is actually supporting that.
Very good. The other issue, of course, of internet activity that's disintermediating, in a way at least, is the issue of the online media. We have the iPhone store, the iTunes, I should say, and we have, of course, the book publishing, magazine publishing, newspapers, and some huge antitrust activity has just occurred in connection with the book publishing online.
Yeah, that's a big move on the part of the Justice Department into a controversial area. This is really not bricks and mortars versus online sales. It's strictly a unique situation within online sales involving digital goods, namely e-books. And to put it in context, you have to go back. Back in 1994, Amazon started selling hard copy books on sale, and in 2000, that's, by the way, 2 years after the Quill decision. Sort of interesting that they started at that point. But in 2007, I believe it is, Amazon rolled out its e-book and its Kindle reader. If you're going to have an e-book, you got to have an e-reader and an e-store operated by Amazon. They pretty much captured the e-book business over the next few years. The problem from the publisher's standpoint is that Amazon got too much control. It not only controlled the distribution system, but it actually controlled the price at which the products were sold under what's called the old wholesale system, which is typical in book and publishing context. The bookstore buys the book at the publisher's price and then discounts and can discount as much as it wants. And what Amazon was doing in order to build up its Kindle network was to discount the New York Times bestseller list down to $9.99. This was below cost pricing basically, in order to build one side of this network, as I described earlier, a two-sided network again. And it would subsidize it with benefits that would come on the other side of the network, mainly increased sales of other products. And so it made a lot of sense for Amazon, but not for the publishers. They were feeling that this was going to displace consumer acceptance of higher prices and might eventually displace them if Amazon were actually to hook up with the authors and start doing its own publishing.
But in response, then we had the counterattack. Then more recently, right, by the iPad.
Yes. Well, what happened is in January 2010, I believe it was, when Apple rolled out its iPad with its ancillary iBookstore and iPad having an iReader. Apple was interested in getting its own content for that system, and the government is alleging that Apple seized upon the discontent of these publishers who were opposed to and looking at Amazon as a predator, and proposed a different kind of a licensing model. It happened to be the same one that – I'm sorry, not licensing, different marketing model. It happened to be the same one that Apple uses for its apps and other products that it sells online, where the vendor enters into a kind of agency relationship with Apple. And Apple just takes a commission, uniformly 30%, I believe it is, on all sales that take place on their online stores, including e-books. The benefit from the publisher's standpoint is that it put control of pricing back into their hands, so that now instead of having the bookstore discounting and potentially engaging in predatory pricing, they would control the price themselves.
But as I understand it, the government's alleging that the publishers and Apple representatives got together and actually, by concerted action, sometimes called a conspiracy, the government alleges, agreed to rig the market, and that is a violation of the antitrust laws.
Yeah, well, this is a
and we've got to go to a break now. I'm sorry.
We'll come back and wrap that up in a moment. It is Tom Scheuer hosting Tom Sharon, Antitrust Laws in the Internet Age on Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Our time went all too quickly on the program today. Tom Scheuer, Tom Sharon, Antitrust Laws in the Internet Age. Tom?
We're going to do a quick wrap-up here with Tom Sharon on the question of the recent allegations that Apple conspired, I guess, to rig prices with book publishers for e-books. Tom, what does the government need to show?
Well, this is the government claims this is a horizontal price-fixing agreement, distinguished from vertical, and that's still per se illegal. They say that this agency arrangement was put in place as the vehicle to implement a horizontal conspiracy to stabilize and raise retail prices in the e-book market. And they've got a circumstantial case, including public statements by the publishers that they are facing a common enemy that they have to engage in collaborative action to attack, that is Amazon and its $9.99 price model, and that there were frequent confidential meetings where they can name the people and location and if not the subject and the subject matter discussed, if not the exact content of the meetings. And they've doubled deletes of emails that show attempts to try to conceal. And then there's this unified action that resulted in nearly uniform agency agreements with the individual agency agreements with the Apple over a very short period of time that have basically the same terms, including a couple of terms that ensure price stability going forward.
Now, why is the iTunes Store then, which basically has a gathering a uniform pricing model and has tie-ins with all of the record companies, why isn't that also under attack then?
Well, the situation there is that that was started from the get-go. That was the model that was set up to begin with, and there is a credible case to be made that Apple simply establish that price for its own purposes.
In effect, Apple, being the prime mover in that market, made the market and set the terms, and that's what was adapted.
Yeah, there's nothing per se illegal about the agency model itself. It's the circumstances in which it was arranged and implemented involving collusion between the publishers and Apple that creates the conspiracy to fix prices that the government's complaining about.
There he is, Tom Sharon, joining us in studio, Antitrust Laws in the Internet Age. Tom, what have we got coming up next week?
Oh, a great program, Steve, to mark the fourth anniversary of our programming here on Minnesota Law, and that's Wills for Heroes, a volunteer lawyers program in Minnesota that offers free wills and estate planning for Minnesota's first responders.
Great, great topic on the program next week. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. And for more information about today's program and all our programs, including podcasts and more, it is Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. Spell it out, Moss and Barnett on WCCO.com. We'll talk to you next Saturday here on News Radio 830 WCCO.